You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
I am pleased to invite you to today's program on Taiwan's response to an evolving security environment. I think we have a very interesting program. I need to say up front that this is a joint venture between CNAPS and the Freeman Chair in Chinese Studies at CSIS. Last week we had a very good program at CSIS on the domestic politics and political issues and economic issues in U.S.-Taiwan PRC relations. And so today we're moving to focus on defense issues. In baseball, this would be referred to as a home and home series. But we're very pleased, as always, to collaborate with CSIS. I'm not going to say anything more and going to invite my friend and colleague, Bonnie Glaser, to introduce our keynote speaker.
Welcome, everyone. We're very pleased to open our session today with a keynote address by Vice Minister Yang Nianzhu, Andrew, who many of you know. I think one of the most important things that Dr. Yang did before becoming Vice Minister of Defense was to establish the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies, CAPS, which many of you know has really become a leading center on the study of the PLA. And, of course, Dr. Yang is also a assistant professor at National Sun Yat-sen University, where, of course, he is on leave since 2009 to take the post of Vice Minister for Policy at the Ministry of National Defense. When we were at lunch, Dr. Yang and I were talking about how difficult, one of the most difficult parts of his job is to answer questions at the legislative UN, and apparently had three grueling sessions last week. So we promise that we won't make this quite as grueling as that, but we will leave time for questions afterwards. So please join me in welcoming Vice Minister Yang.
Thank you, Bonnie, for such a gracious introduction. Equally, I want to thank Richard Bush at Brookings Institute and Bonnie Glaser at the CSIS to jointly hosting this very prestigious panel and inviting me to say something about our own recent assessments of the regional developments and our current preparations for our defense transformation. And I also equally want to thank so many friends and colleagues take the opportunity to come over here to participate in sharing your ideas and your thoughts about the issues and topics which we're going to carry out into discussion today. I was taking my liberty to read one of the my favorite international media, that is the International Herald Tribune for a number of years, and a particular interest in two political cartoons recently appeared in the newspaper a couple of years ago. One is describing the, you know, with the image of a gentleman, obviously is President Xi Jinping, is sort of pushing a trolley in a supermarket. and with a very naughty baby crying and threw everything out of the trolley. And you can see all the pass, you know, the passerbys, the other consumers, customers, particularly those three customers, was hiding their head and covering their ears with tremendous agony in the you know, in their face, and couldn't do anything about it. Those three customers are South Korea, Japan, and the United States. And the daddy, Mr. Xi Jinping, was furious. You can see his face squeezed together and the smoke coming out of his head. That was the political cartoon describing the current Korean Peninsula situation. The second one I also like it very much is the recent one, which shows Prime Minister Abe was riding a water buffalo going to a China store. And you see the manager was standing behind the counter, also President Xi Jinping. And his face also squeezed together and furious. And his head was smoking as well. And Mr. Abe was riding the buffalo and going through the China store and destroying a number of porcelain vessels and so forth. He was very happy about that. That's the second cartoon I read recently. But I want to mention there's two cartoons basically reflecting similar impressions from our interpretation of the recent changes taking place in the Western Pacific area, which is also highlighted by our 2013 Quadrennial Defense Review. Our main theme in terms of our assessments of the regional security and the strategic situation can be summarized by two words. One is uncertainty. Second is escalating. Certainly, these two words doesn't represent good developments in the future, but also at the same time, urging all the actors in the region or around the world should take extra effort to de-escalate the tension and resolve the problems and come to a more sensible discussion on how to manage the situation more peacefully and stably. And I think that we are facing the kind of changes taking place very fastly, rapidly in the region, not just about the assertion of the sovereignty issues, but very much a reflection of the changes, rapid changes taking place in the course of modernization in concerned domestic societies. For example, in China, you see there are various changes taking place as a result of economic developments, as development of a new middle class, and you have a lot of netizens in China also expressing their views and affecting the policies as well. So those are the issues continuously affecting, I believe, the Chinese concerns and their policy-making process. Equally in Japan, you see more proactive citizens or opinions shaping political leaders' behavior and their decisions as well. So those are the factors continuously putting extra elements into the decision-making process, and certainly we're adding new elements in terms of shaping the perceptions of their separate individual societies. Same thing happening in Korean Peninsula. You have a newly selected young leader, Kim Jong-un, and he's throwing everything out of the trolley, and you can't do anything about it, right? It's not that we follow the South Koreans' current policy. They call it strategic patience. Yes, but what's next? You know, you cannot leave the issue to continue to expand in their own way. You have to find ways to resolve the core issue there. So I think that I hope this will be the lesson learned for everybody to take the extra step and efforts to solve the problem. It leads to our interpretation and our analysis of our current approaches in terms of addressing sensitive and complicated issues, particularly in the East China Sea. Last year, in August, President Ma Ying-jeou put forward this so-called East Sea Initiative. Not many people really believe it can make any contribution to the region. And a lot of people criticize this is the fantasy out of Taiwanese leader. But if you look at the follow-up developments recently, especially after the our government signed a peace, officially a court with Japanese authority. And it creates a different kind of dimension for people to think about. This is the kind of thing that we want to ease the tension and also to enhance the mutual benefits. I don't know whether Japan is learning lessons from our initiative from last August, but certainly the events taking place in the region make the leaders or the people to think about how to make extra efforts to make peace instead of making escalation or tensions. So this is a step forward. At least we can learn from these lessons that things have to be addressed with the efforts and all the considerations. So I think that this is the message contained in our QDR. There's no other alternative. Steps has to be taken, adopted. Efforts has to be made. Otherwise, we are going to face the situation which I mentioned earlier, that is the uncertainty and escalating, which is no good for our future generation, and we will make mistakes if we don't see there is a need to resolve the issue today. The second thing I want to address is the what are we doing at home facing this complicated regional security challenges and also ongoing process across the Taiwan Strait, which we are continuing to support this so-called rapprochement to ease tensions. We firmly believe long-term peace and stability can only be realized through self-strength. Nobody is going to help you. You have to pay great attention to strengthen your own ability to deal with any possible negative impact in the future, even hurting your national interests. So, in the process of conducting this peaceful rapprochement across the strait, we also putting great efforts to conduct necessary transformation of our self-defense capability for the purpose of make sure that enemy will not read the message wrong and conduct unnecessary steps to use force to achieve their political objectives. So we meant to continuously putting efforts to strengthening our self-defense so that to compromise the intention to use force against Taiwan in the future. So what are we doing right now? Basically focusing on two things. One is to implement the so-called voluntary policy, which is very challenging and difficult task to fulfill with. But at the same time, in order to facilitate this important policy to be implemented, we are closely working with our parliament, the Legislative Yuan, to amend the legislations or improving the conditions to accommodate the needs for volunteer system. We're also working very hard with our interagency collaboration to smooth the bureaucracies and regulations to facilitate better accommodation for volunteer system. At the same time, we are asking for more resources funding to support this program. And of course, we are making adjustments, improvements in our own ministerial regulations, current measures, in order to encourage and attract more talented young people to join the armed forces, which certainly takes a lot of efforts and costs a lot of time to do it. We are not expecting that this will be fulfilled in a short term, but certainly it will be continuous effort in the future. Second, we are also taking more emphasis and more steps to develop asymmetrical capability with advanced technology as well. We are doing this for a number of years already, and we are also doing this with a close collaboration with our friends at the Pentagon, and also identifying areas for enhancing our asymmetrical capability. In the process of developing this new and important steps of defense transformation, we solve the problems of our service rivalries. We solve the problems of consensus building. And now we are entering into a more realistic steps to identify areas and the priorities for asymmetrical measures. We listed one example in our QDR, that is the mine warfare capability. We have other steps to follow in the future as well. So you will see in the future that this will be the focus in terms of our defense transformation. It will be cost-effective. It will be more indigenous and certainly collaborating with our allies and friends. It's not very juicy, but it will be very much objective-oriented. And we'll make sure that this will be the essence and foundation for the future capability building process. All these efforts we made in terms of enhancing our self-defense capability is to support peace building process, is to assure stability and progress in the region, and also at the same time is to support our democratic institutions and our freedom. So I think this is the area that we should make extra effort. And we hope that the audience in Washington, D.C. can understand we are making our contribution, and also to support the effort we made in Taipei. Last week, we just finished our major annual imagery exercises, Hangguan 29. And I can tell you this, that in the course of conducting this Hangguan exercises, we already implement some of the astrometrical capabilities newly developed by our armed forces. And this is a further step to demonstrate that there is a consensus already achieved, and the services also witness the initiation of this joint efforts is taking place and taking its effects. So I think that we will continuously to put those efforts into our routine exercises so that our officers and men can learn from these exercises and bring about more consensus and resources allocations in the course of building more effective astrometrical capability in the future. And I think that my presentation will be stopped here, and certainly I welcome questions from the audience, and thank you for your attention.
Here we are. Well, thank you very much, Minister Young. I'm sure that there are lots of questions. I will restrain myself and open up the floor. Please wait for the microphone. Identify yourself, and please do ask a question. Who would like to be first? Okay, right over here.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey Lin. I'm a student with George Washington University. And thank you for coming here today, Mr. Minister. I was wondering that in bigger, more sophisticated projects, is a trend towards indigenization as opposed to buying foreign weapons. For example, in the QDR, I believe, it mentions that Taiwan is looking into building a fighter with fifth-generation characteristics, if I recall correctly. Thank you.
I mean, the first generation or fifth generation, yeah, in terms of punching the speaker. Well, our policy in terms of weapon system development is to go for the, essentially to look into the area of indigenous capability in terms of developments. If our indigenous effort cannot be realized in terms of new weapon systems, then we will seek overseas or foreign acquisition. So that's the principle of our weapon system development program. In terms of so-called the fifth generation fighter aircrafts, what the QDR emphasizes is to seek the fifth generation aircraft. It didn't mention particularly whether it will be indigenously made or acquired from the foreign source. So this will be our future programs of seeking advanced fighter jets to be part of our self-defense apparatus. Is that answering your question? Okay.
Okay, Nadia. Wait for the microphone, please. Up front over here.
Hi, Andrew. Welcome back. Nadia Chow from Liberty Times. You just mentioned the fishery agreement with Japan. I just wonder, can you elaborate a little bit about the security implication for that agreement? You know, we are in a contentious region. A lot of people, you know, a lot of countries actually have different claims on sovereignties, and that's a source of tension. What do you think this will imply to other cases like the South China Sea?
Thank you. As you read the contents of those agreements, there are two areas need to be addressed. One is that the agreement has made the area available for Taiwanese fishing boats to fish in the much wider regions, which defined by both sides as part of the, you know, it's much bigger than the previous Taiwanese fishery grounds in the region. Second, both parties agree that in the course of conducting fishing, no party can apply the domestic laws to the other side. I think that's the way to avoid miscalculation and to avoid direct confrontation. So that certainly requires further discussion. What does it mean by the in the course of conducting fishery and patrolling? No domestic laws can be applied to the other party. That's certainly in need of a further discussion in that part. But in principle, it sets the buffer because the fishery region has been expanded. So it has created a much bigger buffer of to avoid direct confrontation. Secondly, in the agreement, in principle, it has ruled out the possibility to apply domestic laws to be used to the other party. I think that also is a measure to avoid direct confrontation and to avoid miscalculation. So in that sense, I consider that in terms of security, there are measures to be adopted including into the agreement, at least to create some kind of buffer to or regulated behavior to avoid miscalculation and misregulation as well. But I think that the agreement also provides the venue for both authorities to have more frequent and institutionalized channels of communication to deal with potential problems in the future, which certainly is another measure to be adopted to enhance security, mutual security, instead of creating gray areas or uncertainties to facilitate tension in the future.
Eric McVaden.
Eric McVaden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Andrew, I think you deserve special congratulations. You must have set a record for the time you've been in that job. And not a lot of people who sat in that chair have stayed very long. So I commend you, but I do have a question.
Thank you, sir.
Have you emphasized cyber warfare in your QDR?
We do mention the importance of paying great attention to deal with cyber attacks in the QDR. Actually, we're also taking realistic steps to cope with that. I don't want to go into details what sort of steps we are taking at the moment, but this is certainly is an extremely important concern for our national security and as well as for our national defense. And there are two structures being created since last year. One is presided over by the cabinet, basically looking to the protection between governmental systems and the private systems. And the other is being created by National Security Council, which is particularly emphasizing the importance of protecting national key junctures and the key infrastructures. And certainly MND is a very important part of this national security, cyber security mechanisms. We are working close, very, very closely together.
Okay, this side.
Thank you, Mr. Yang. My name is Dong Huiyu with China Review News Agency. And you emphasize the self-defense capability, particularly the asymmetric capability in your speech. Under this policy, how do you think the necessity and how critical it is for Taiwan to purchase the F-16 CD in the near term? Did you get any information from U.S. government after you came to the Washington, D.C., that the Obama administration is considering selling F-16 CD to Taiwan in the near term? Thank you.
Well, if you read our policy carefully, at least after we received the approval from the U.S. Congress to provide F-16 AB retrofit programs in September 2011, I think so.
Right.
Yeah, we've been emphasizing that we're still in need of future advanced jet fighters, and any deliberation in terms of the requirements of the future advanced jet fighters has to be superseding, at least superseding the upgraded or retrofitted F-16 AB model. So you have to understand that the evaluation or the assessments for a new generation of fighter aircraft takes a longer perspective. Currently, that F-16 AB retrofit programs certainly were proceeded with a number of years, and it will provide sufficient air defense for our overall defense capability. So when we talk about the future advanced generation of fighter aircrafts, then you have to make assessments, and you will see what will be available requirements in the future, what are the options in the future. If you look at that, certainly you will reduce or you will rule out some of the options available today. So we are talking about the future requirements, not urgent, immediate today's requirements that we have mentioned. So that's our policy position on this issue. No, we didn't get any information from the U.S. counterpart. Yes,
Richard.
Richard, sorry about that.
That's okay. We chose the same person.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Andrew. I wonder if I could ask you to elaborate a little bit on how the defense strategy and the military strategy that you've described fits within President Ma's larger security strategy for Taiwan. Thanks.
Thank you, Richard, for to offer me this opportunity to make my interpretation of these three cardinal principles. We actually develop our defense strategy based upon President Mao's overall national strategy, which is to to stabilize the cross-strait relations and to making efforts for Taiwanese meaningful international participation. And certainly he emphasized the importance and the need to integrate diplomatic and defensive efforts to support these two prominent initiatives. So these are the three principal pillars for President Ma's strategy to enhance our national security and protecting our national security interests. So we follow those overall security perspective in the course of formulating our defense strategy to emphasize, we call it a hard rock defense. That is to say, to enhance our effective deterrence, at the same time to consolidate our self-defense capability based on asymmetrical efforts. So that's our defense policy. I call it defense policy. And followed by defense policy on the military strategy, that is to say that we have to be more, you know, to streamlining our the total armed forces, make it smaller but more superb and more leaner and stronger. So this is the guidelines for our defense transformation, which has been followed at least starting from 5 years ago. So you have these three-dimensional, three tiers of constructing or developing our national security strategies and come up with the necessary and sufficient defense policies to support this objective and producing the guidelines for our force transformation, which has been conducted and implemented until today. This has not been vividly put forward by the QDR, but between lines you can see that's the kind of systematical arrangements of our defense planning in the future.
Okay. Over there?
Sorry.
You're used to being in charge. And I understand that.
Hi, Richard Shin with Economist Inc. My question is, you know, you mentioned the China's possible military action and the deterrence effect. And so the first question is really, what is the likelihood that such military action would be in the short run or in the long run that, you know, you need this, that deterrence? And the second is, given that risk and given China's continued increased spending, military spending, what is the likely cost of maintaining this deterrence effect, and would probably continue to support that in the long run?
What's the can you reframe, repeat the second question again?
Yeah, the second question is really, given the risk assessment you have on the first question, and given China's continued increasing military spending, the cost of deterrence will continue to rise for Taiwan as well. And so the question is, you know, what would that cost increase be, and would the public continue to support such increase in spending?
Okay. Number one, we never underestimated Beijing's intention and ability, capability to use force. Their intention is alive and kicking because they never renounce use of force. Beijing still holding the option to use non-peaceful means, even codified by law. So what else can you say that about Beijing's intention? I mean, it's very clear, abundantly clear, that if they fail their so-called peaceful unification process and they see there's an opportunity available, they will be encouraged to use force. And that's our interpretation. So we never underestimated Beijing's intention. And secondly, as we mentioned repeatedly again, we are not, as you said, Beijing spent a lot of resources in terms of defense modernization in the past and continuously putting a lot of resources in that regard. We are not and we cannot compete with Beijing. An imbalance is already been created for a number of years already. So we are seeking ways to fend off the options Beijing will be adopted in terms of fulfilling their objective by non-peaceful means. So those are the areas which we are focusing on. So we emphasize asymmetrical capability. We are not competing militarily with Beijing. You cannot compete. You are small, they are big. They have big economy, you have a very small limited resources. So it's no way to compete with Beijing. So we emphasize that what we are trying to do is to make enemy or Beijing's intention cannot be successful. Their attempts will not be fulfilled. So that's our objective.
David Brown.
David Brown from SAIS. Thank you, Andrew. As always, interesting comments. I would like to ask you to say a little bit more about asymmetric measures that you talked about. You mentioned those as being something that came out of a collaborative process with your U.S. partners. I can remember a decade ago when some of the asymmetric ideas that Taipei had were not very popular, and the administration actually tried to discourage them. Washington now seems to have a very different approach to these issues. I have two questions against that background. One, are the asymmetric measures that you are adopting ones that grew out of Taiwan's suggestions that are being supported by the U.S. or the other way around? And secondly, are there any ideas or any areas where the U.S. is actively discouraging you from trying to develop certain kinds of systems?
Thank you to bring up this question. One is very much our initiative, and frankly speaking, being supported by U.S. The kind of asymmetric capability we are talking about, I mentioned today, very much in terms of our indigenous effort, is not supported or provided by United States. It's not, as I mentioned, very sophisticated, high-tech in essence. We actually come up with the ideas and indigenous efforts which been consulted and frequently discussed with our partners and very much suitable for our geography and our environment. And most importantly, it's cost effective. So those are the areas and items I think that we have confidence in terms of developing. And it is critically important because it will also boost in our confidence that we can actually produce those things ourselves. And you don't need a replacement. You don't need a spare parts supply. And what you need to do is to continuously improving those capabilities. I think even they are not shiny and fashionable in terms of technology, but it is very effective. You will fulfill your mission objectives, and I think that's what we are looking for.
Ken Allen.
Thank you. Vice Minister Yang, I'm Ken Allen from DGI. Two parts. Could you talk about any obstacles to your military trying to go to an all-volunteer enlisted force? And the second part, one of Bonnie's favorite subjects, is confidence-building measures. She's been working on this for 10 years, and there are several steps in military-to-military confidence-building measures. Where do you stand in actually dealing with the PLA, track one, track one and a half, track two for confidence building, strictly military to military? Thank you.
Well, the obstacles for in terms of implementing volunteer systems, there are two parts. One is that it's not just the Ministry of National Defense responsibility. It takes a lot of effort from other governmental agencies as well. So you have to overcome difficulties and making up everybody talking the same language. That's not an easy process. So I spend a lot of time to called upon the interagency collaboration and for the last year or two. Second, in terms of obstacles and challenges, is to convince the legislators to amend the current legislations or to enact new legislation to support this program, because oftenly, if you want to implement policies, you have to follow the due process. Otherwise, it's not going to be realized. So that's another area that we facing our challenges. Number three is, how are you going to overcome the difficulties of improving your own infrastructures? That's not necessary to say that you need more money to put into it. Money is not a problem in terms of resources allocation. But the problem is that whether, again, it's also related to the regulations and legal arrangements. You need to speed up the process of improving your fringe benefits, your housing accommodations, you know, all kinds of aspects of your benefits, so that you can encourage youngsters to consider to be recruited to join the armed forces, because you have a better profile than other professions to provide opportunities for youngsters to seek their own future objective. And certainly you have to provide better venues for their education and for their professionalism trainings and so forth. So it's a package. So if you don't fulfill your objective in terms of solving all the problems at the same time, that's our fundamental challenges. You are facing all kinds of problems and challenges together, and you have to deal with them simultaneously, and you find you don't have many hands available. Yeah. So that's the difficulty we are facing right now. But we are doing the best we can. Yeah.
The second question was about
Oh, yes, I forgot. CBMs, yes, that's your question too.
Yes.
Well, I can tell this, we have no tracks in terms of conducting CBM right now, either first track or second track or third track. But it is an important issue. In fact, we have our internal study groups. As a matter of fact, I'm also heading or chairing a task force within the MND, specifically looking into the cross-strait security and military issues, including what are the options that the mainland China is putting forward in terms of facilitating, they call it the Junsanquan Hujinjizi, which is slightly different from the CBM. We also talk to some of the scholars or experts who are continuously discussing these issues with their counterparts in mainland China, and to familiarize some of the ideas, fresh ideas emerging from those discussions. So we are not losing track about what's going on between the other side, but we are at the same time also evaluating the feasibilities or possibilities, whether this is possible for Taiwan to pursue or to respond to the process. But I think from the government's point of view, we consider that the CBM or confidence building measures or mil-mil contact cannot be taken place or realized unless the political difficulties being peacefully resolved or any political resolution has been realized. This is also part of the consensus developed by the cabinet as well.
We'll take one last question over here.
Yes, Tina Chong with Voice of America. I'd like to know that recently a number of high-profile cases, espionage cases involving the Taiwanese military personnel. Do you have any concern about sensitive intelligence being compromised? And also, secondly, how would you describe the morale in Taiwan's military during this time of transformation against the backdrop of the rapprochement with China? Thank you.
Well, it's really unfortunate that we have this kind of espionage incidents taking place. In reality, it's being uncovered by our internal efforts. Fortunately, we have uncovered those attempts or behavior activities early in their stage. And in the course of conducting our investigation, we discovered that so-called sensitive or classified materials involved in those activities are pretty much outdated. It's not our current or recent classified informations. So in terms of compromising our interests, we consider and we try our best to keep it at a minimum. But it provides the opportunity for us to look into the espionage cases and certainly finding ways to deal with it. And as you know, that Taiwan is an open society, and since the both sides has conducted direct interactions, there are many opportunities for men in China to allude and making attempts to penetrate into our security apparatus. And also we fix those gray areas, and also at the same time conducting necessary measures to cope with the future developments as well. So far, as I can see, the damages caused by those espionage is minimum. It's been fixed, and we're finding measures to cope with the future trend. As to the second question,
morale
has not been compromised. I think I find that even we don't want this kind of things taking place, but for our current personnel and officers and men, they've been alerted by the espionage cases, and they consider that the enemy threat is real and genuine, is imminent. So I think that it's the morale has been boosted instead of being compromised, because they consider the enemy is still taking whatever they can to penetrate our security system. So I think that's important, because people being alert that the enemy is still next to you, is not far away from the other side.
Well, this has been really terrific. I want to thank you, Minister Young, for taking time out during your visit to Washington, as I know you always do, to talk to those of us in think tanks and the public about the security situation in Taiwan, about your defense strategy, and helping us to understand the recent developments. And I'd also like to thank you for your contribution to U.S.-Taiwan relations.
Thank you very much.
Which we trust that you will continue to make a good contribution. Please join me in thanking Minister Young.
Thank you very much.